Welcome to the Just Fly Performance Podcast, Episode 10. Today on the show, I have Ryan Horn, Director of Athletic Performance for Men's Basketball at Wake Forest University. This episode of the Just Fly Performance Podcast is brought to you by Simply Faster. Simply Faster is a one-stop online shop for some of the best athletic performance technology in the world, distributing items such as the Freelab Timing System, Gymaware, K-Box, 1080 Sprint, and the Speedmat. Since I own and use many of these items, particularly the Freelab Pro Coach Timing System, K-Box, and the 1080 Sprint, I can say with confidence that Simply Faster breaks anyone in the reach of today's best training technology. It would be difficult to imagine my current experience in coaching track and field without having the Freelab system in my toolbox. It has revolutionized both my workouts and my assessment of athletes. Being able to look at the 10-meter fly capability of dozens of athletes in a matter of seconds is an amazing thing if you're a track coach or sport coach alike. The Freelab system is incredibly versatile, wireless, quick to set up, and compact. The K-Box and 1080 Sprint are also incredible tools for any coach looking to build speed, agility, and implement training scenarios that are beyond the reach of even the most furnished traditional weight room. The K-Box is by far the most efficient way to deliver smooth, eccentric overload to athletes in multiple planes of ground-based movement. The 1080 Sprint is being used right now by great coaches to train some of the fastest sprinters in the world, and soon the 1080 might be synonymous with high-performance speed training. One of the things to consider with Simply Faster is that the customer service is second to none. I've never had as quick of feedback with any product as I have with Christopher at Simply Faster, and anyone who makes a purchase with him is in great hands. If you're interested in acquiring some of the best high-tech training equipment available that is being used by high schools, top NCAA institutions, professional teams, and the best private training facilities, stop by simplyfaster.com. That's SimplyFaster.com and find the future of coaching technology that is making a big difference. Hi, and welcome to the show. Today's guest is Ryan Horn. Ryan is an industry leader in integrating core strength and conditioning practices into the now coming in upon us wave of modern technology, monitoring, and the database movement that's now permeating the field of sports science, strength and conditioning. And I'm really excited to talk to Ryan today because Ryan manages this role of a strength coach who uses technology and data with great wisdom and insight. And he manages it with a coaching first, data second mentality, as you'll see when we get to the show. Ryan is also spearheading the use of inertial training means with collegiate basketball players, as well as finding out how this training modality influences force application patterns. Today, Ryan and I are going to talk about a variety of topics pertaining to training collegiate basketball players, including plyometrics, global athletic development, energy systems, inertial training, monitoring on a shoestring budget, and more. So with that said, let's get to the show. All right, welcome to the show. Glad to have you on today, Ryan.
I appreciate you having me.
How's your summer going? How's basketball and all things strength and conditioning?
Well, basketball never stops. So that's the great thing about our profession. It's consistent, so we know what to expect week in and week out. But the summertime's a great time of year for us because we get a chance to actually, you know, train the kids, be with them, get some work done, and it's cool to see their progress and see them start putting things together. So it's a good time for us to take a step back, spend some time with family, get our guys better, work on some individual things, and get ourselves ready for a long season. So everything's good.
Great to hear, man. Something I'd always like to start off my podcast with, I'm always interested in how people got where they're at, both athletically and then developmentally as career-wise. So what's your background, Ryan, as an athlete, and what brought you into strength and conditioning and where you're at now?
You know, my brother was actually a competitive bodybuilder. So early on in life, you know, I always had this this early need and want to get in the weight room and be like my big brother. And I used to go to the gym with him and watch him train and read all of his flex magazines and muscular development. That was probably my earliest exposure to training, even though I look back now and that might be a little bit off-based. But it was still, you know, part of my formative years of being around guys that have been in the gym for a long time and developing that love for the weight room. So I played a lot of sports growing up, mostly football, in basketball, Played that through high school, enjoyed training in high school. I've actually trained a lot of my teammates in high school. Would do the workouts with our high school coach, which did a great job introducing us to the weight room and ran a great program. But then I was leaving, going to train at the Gold's Gym myself, doing two sessions a day, and training some of my teammates with me. Went to college, started off East Stroudsburg University. I actually tore my ACL my senior year of high school, played my whole senior year with a torn ACL. Did not get it repaired till after my first semester as a freshman in college when I was at East Stroudsburg University. Ended up having my knee repaired, went back to James Madison University, was there for a couple seasons. Didn't really pan out from a football perspective, so I kind of took a different road, went back home. Still loved the weight room, still loved being a coach, experienced some injuries when I was growing up and both as a player, and wanted to find a way to be able to help people and kind of develop them so that wouldn't happen to them, help them learn from some of my mistakes and some of the things that happened to me. So then I went to Shepherd University, finished my degree, no strength conditioning program there. So I had to go out and find my own resources and continue an education. Luckily, I met Todd Hammer, who gave me my first internship at Robert Morris University, who then introduced me to Tim Contos, who's the director of strength conditioning at Virginia Commonwealth University, who gave me my GA opportunity, was a GA for 5 months, then became full-time my first year on the job, was there for 5 years. Was University of Tulsa, was there for 3 seasons, and then now we've been at Wake Forest starting our 3rd season now. So I've been blessed from a standpoint that I've gotten, had the chance to work for a lot of great mentors and a lot of great coaches. I've worked with a plethora of teams and sports, not just football and basketball, but also a lot of Olympic sports. So I've learned along the way how to deal with a variety of personalities, both from a coaching and athlete standpoint. So I'm very, grateful that I had the chance to really expand my scope of practice, so to speak, and work with a lot of different teams. And it kind of brought me to where I'm at right now. But I've always wanted to do this. This is, my first book I bought was Conditioning for Football. It was the Husker Power book. Complete Conditioning for Football was the first book. My dad bought it for me when I was in my sophomore year of high school, and I knew from that point on that I wanted to be a strength and conditioning coach, and the rest is just history. It's been quite the journey, but very blessed and very thankful of where I'm at today.
Yeah, it's great stuff. It's always good to hear of people who were just loving that stuff back in high school. It brings me back. I remember myself, Muscular Development was one of the first magazines I was really into as a kid as well. And it's funny, those magazines were a lot better back in the day, like 15 years ago, than they are now. That's for sure.
It wasn't 90% supplement ads and before and after pics and everything else that went into it. But I don't think a lot of people would. I think you talked to a lot of strength conditioning coaches that have been in the field for a while. I think everybody's read a couple Muscular Developments and Muscle Mags along the way, and had Arnold's, bodybuilding Bible and encyclopedia. But I think those are all things that are important as you make your way throughout the profession.
Yeah, absolutely. I really like it too that you mentioned you were training people early. And even though I think we think sometimes that having these degrees, strengthening exercise science or whatnot program, but I'll always take, experience in training people early on over formal classwork. So it's always great to have that early experience, getting those 10,000 hours plus or minus a few thousand right off the bat.
Yeah, I tell you what, I got a lot more than 10,000 bad hours, so I'm hoping I can catch up a little bit. I know a lot of things that don't work, so we'll see where we go. But yeah, we're definitely heading in the right direction.
Yeah. So with your experience, everything you've been through, Ryan, and basketball especially, what are 3 main things that you would prioritize for the development of like today's modern, over specialized college basketball player? And what are some of the biggest things that if you had to list some of the biggest things that those players need in their physical development, what would you say those things are?
I think when you look back, it's not just basketball players. I know I discussed that because that's what I train primarily. That's the only team I train. But I think you look at the culture in general, there's a big emphasis on skill. There's a big emphasis on structured and organized sport. And I think the development of just general physical preparation is something that's been kind of pushed to the backside, so to speak. physical education programs in schools are pretty much non-existent right now. They still happen, but some of the protocols and the programs that they're running, you know, I think kids are just missing out on a lot of basic movement skills and basic coordination, rhythmic skipping, things like that that you just never really had a chance to push. And when you look at basketball players, we're talking about guys in high school that are averaging over 100 games a year. That basically come to us with college mileage already on their bodies. So they lack strength, they lack stability. Most of the time, most of the conditioning and fitness that they get is derived from playing games and practicing. So there's a lot of gaps to be filled, so to speak. So the first step for us is understanding that as a coach, you know, we help guys achieve personal records, but we also have to be able to achieve personal relationships with these guys. And I think a lot of times the results are going to become, you know, after you've built the relationships and you educate these athletes of why do I need to focus, you know, all my physical preparation, my physical development, you know, why can't I just go on the court and just practice basketball and work on my skill? And you still need to do that. But we try to explain to the guys that the bigger the base, higher the peak. And luckily the culture, with social media and things of that nature, our guys are seeing guys like LeBron, Steph, Russell Westbrook. They're seeing these guys train. They're seeing these guys eat well. They're seeing the guys they look up to are taking care of their bodies and protecting the investment and being a pro. So we try to explain to our guys that, hey, we got to be a pro now. We got to take care of our habits, and our habits are going to build, you know, our daily action, and that's going to determine the final outcome. So I think it's important that you have a system in place that educates your student athletes of why every aspect in your program is important. And then how it fits in to making them a more resilient, more robust and durable athlete, which is the number one priority for our program, is to improve player availability. If a guy can jump 40 inches in the air and he looks good in a tank top, but he's sitting next to me on the bench clapping and cheering, handing out water bottles, it's really not going to help us. So we understand as a staff, have a great staff in place of interns and Joe Grachan, who's our director of women's basketball, he also assists with the men. We understand that elite skill and elite talent doesn't always equal elite preparation. So when the guys come in, you know, the great thing about training basketball players is you get to keep it simple. You get to work on basic skills, developing strength, developing stability, adding lean muscle mass, teaching guys how to hydrate, teaching guys how to eat. So when the guys come in, we understand what we're working with. It's not necessarily a thing where, oh man, how do you train basketball players? They don't like to train. Well, it's not because they don't like to train. It's haven't been exposed to an athletic performance program on a consistent and a structured basis. So what we see with these guys when they come in, there's a transition period. All of our freshmen go through a 6-week, which basically they come in the middle of the summer. They go through a 6-week block of GPP, and we're kind of evaluating, assessing how do they move, how do they respond to stress, how do they adapt, you know, what gaps do we need to fill as far as their mental and physical preparation is concerned, and then we kind of go from there. So I think it's, for us, we got guys that can dribble but can't skip. Can't run in a straight line. They just haven't been exposed to that type of work. So I think it's the biggest thing you have to work on is one, basic movement skills. You have to get these guys stronger. I have a lot of guys that are masters of a momentum. Strength is corrective in nature when applied appropriately, as far as I'm concerned. So we have guys that can jump 40 inches on an approach jump, but when they do their standing verts, you know, they're 26, 25 inches. That's a huge lack of starting strength and explosive strength that's going to help with eccentric rate of force development, landing, things of that nature. So I think it's a multifaceted endeavor based on the athlete and what his training age is. But the biggest thing for me is you got to teach these kids. You got to teach them. You got to be able to reach them. And then once you can do that, the results speak for themselves. And the results motivate those athletes and generate compliance and buy-in. But there's a lot of behavioral changes that need to happen as well.
Yeah, I love that point you made about, you know, the 40-inch vertical and looking good in your tank top. I'm a track and field guy, and I fully appreciate all those highlight clips of the guys jumping and touching really high, and it looks good and everyone loves it, but it really just does come back to, are you playing? Are you healthy? Can you do it week in and week out without getting hurt? And it might not be the sexiest thing all the time, but if you're keeping guys on the floor, that's really and keeping them robust and healthy, it's really what it all comes down to.
Yeah, and simple's not sexy anymore. I think our profession's coming full circle. It was as complex as it could be, and now it's you know, kind of going full circle and simple is starting to become a little bit sexier, but you know, simple doesn't mean easy. And simple is just the way we apply and the way we view training. My guys don't need glorified practice sessions, you know, disguised as weight training sessions. Our guys need to develop. They need to train. They need to train hard. They need to train hard for a consistent period of time. And I think those are things we look at. But same thing with basketball. It's a jumping sport, but we can't get lost in the sky. We have to understand how these athletes interact with gravity, not only how they decelerate, but understand the game from positional demand, positional demands, but also understanding the biomotor and bioenergetic platform for which these athletes have to be able to operate off of.
Yeah, for sure. That's a great point. And there's such specific demands that are needed, and fulfilling those keeps people on the floor. I've heard you talk a little bit, Ryan, about the basketball season. It's a grind. And also just that it maybe it, compared to some other sports, there's a little bit less time to round athletes out. Mm-hmm. If you were in charge of basketball, the basketball season for like high school, college, how the training year unfolds and when athletes would have time to work on, basically go back to general strength and coordination, would there be anything that you would change that would allow basketball players to have more time to build the base of that pyramid?
I think it's a tough situation because in college especially, it's not just about playing basketball. There's a lot of other motivating factors, whether it's, financial, exposure, media, whatever it may be. You're not going to stop basketball players from playing basketball. Football players aren't putting shoulder pads on and going and playing pickup football every night. Like, these guys love being on the court. They love playing. I think what you need to understand as a strength conditioning coach for basketball is you have to be complementary and you have to know where these windows of development exist. And for us, those windows occur, postseason, during that transition block from our postseason period into our spring session. There is a couple week block in there where we can work on some more structurally demanding things as far as bringing these guys up throughout the season, filling the gaps, and then, cleaning up the mess, so to speak, so we can do some tissue remodeling, triphasic type work to work on tendon health and get these guys where they need to be, establish some more range of motion. And the thing with basketball, it's just repetitive ranges of motion. Same movements all the time, small joint angles. So it gets very monotonous and plastic as far as how these guys are moving. So for us, it's just looking at the annual plan, having a plan in place, understanding the demands of the game, understanding what type of training modalities are compatible with their practice and game schedule, and then finding windows throughout the year where we can develop those things. So spring's an important time for us. And then right now, our summer period, which really we get 8 weeks where we can really emphasize strength, power, and acceleration. Those are a big time. That's a big time for us. Now we still practice 2 hours a week, and the guys are still playing pickup. So we have to still be able to balance what things we push. So like right now during the summer, we work on acceleration. We work on improving strength, both maximal strength, relative strength, but also explosive strength as well. And we're helping develop acceleration, power. And then obviously during this period, it's a great time for us to work on our eccentric strength or eccentric rate of force development, but also our deceleration or landing mechanics. So we try to make sure during this time that we understand they're getting exposure on the court, they're practicing. So our fitness, unless it's a big guy that his preparation is very, very low or he has a very low training age, a lot of times we don't have to really focus as much on the conditioning and the fitness. We'll fill the gaps with some low intensity aerobic work. Most of our guys come in, they're a little anaerobic because they don't really have a huge aerobic base. And then we'll fill in some gaps on the high end as well, as far as what we're not getting on the court from a high intensity perspective is concerned. But it's a very fluid, very dynamic periodization model as far as how we run our program. But that's the biggest thing for me. You just have to look at the schedule, understand what your head coach wants, and then prepare them for practice. Our guys are going to break in practice. They're not breaking in the games. Our games, guys will play anywhere between 10 to 35, 38 minutes. But in basketball, it's a 40-minute game, but you'll practice for 3 hours. So it's like you know, you have to look at that and kind of view it as, okay, here's our practice schedule. What do my athletes need to be able to basically withstand? You know, how is my head coach going to train these guys? How is our system? How do we practice? You know, what do I need to do to prepare them for that? So that's kind of how we break out our year. So the first thing is you have to organize, you have to have a plan, and you have to execute that plan and be prepared to remain fluid and dynamic with how you implement it.
Yeah, I really like that point about football compared to basketball, and you know how football players don't just throw on pads and play pickup football, you know, all season long.
Exactly. And even with football, they spend 60% of their year training. They only spend around 40% of their year preparing. Basketball, over 90% of our year is spent competing or practicing. So from that standpoint, and plus football in high school, these guys are at least training. I'm not saying that it's great or it's bad or anything else, but at least they're exposed to it and are training and have some type of base or elevated training age before they get to us. Our guys are usually starting from square one, and that's better. It's easier to teach and it is correct, but you know, those are all things you have to understand before you start programming.
Yeah, definitely. I'm going to get a little bit into more some of the nuts and bolts here with some of the strength training things that you do.
Okay.
I had a small rabbit trail, actually, something you were mentioning made me think about this, because I've seen a lot of ways to approach, you know, the aerobic component of basketball.
Yeah.
And so what is just some benchmarks you want to see that tell you that a player is ready for the season from an aerobic standpoint?
Some of the initial things we're looking at, two big markers for us are going to be resting heart rate and then our heart rate recovery. So what we're looking at there to look at basic cardiac efficiency and cardiac development, we're looking for a low resting heart rate, which allows us to understand that our athletes are efficient. They have, you know, decent cardiac output. So that's going to basically allow us to really look at an athlete and say, okay, they're going to recover well. They're more tolerant to stress. They're more parasympathetic dominant, which is going to give us a chance for our athletes to be able to basically either flip the switch and go when they need to, but when they need to flip the switch off, they're able to recover, so it's not this chronic demand over time. So a lot of times our guys come in with elevated resting heart rates, and then we implement some cardiac output work, whether it's via an extensive warm-up, which we'll throw in, you know, mock speed drill, skipping, med ball work, things that are a little bit less structurally taxing, but keeping the heart rate in that 120 to 140 range, depending on who the athlete is. Now, those prescriptions, as I've learned over time, you know, aren't as exact as I once thought they were. But, you know, our athletes are able to, you know, maintain a conversation. We keep the pace up and they're moving. Then we're looking at heart rate recovery. Majority of our guys, we want their heart rate to drop anywhere between 30 to 50 beats in a minute. So once we run a practice drill for running our preseason beep test, we use the intermittent level 2 test, intermittent recovery test. If we're running that beep test throughout, we're going to track their heart rate recovery. After that, we're going to kind of get a view on a daily basis from an internal load standpoint. How well does their heart rate drop? Does it stay elevated? What's their cardiovascular response to exercise? So those two things right there give us a good idea of what their aerobic potential is like. And then we look at heart rate data during practice and during training sessions, and we're looking for big peaks and drop-offs. You know, we want to see mountains. We don't want to see plains. So what we want to look at is we want to see our guys' heart rates get up. We want to see them move well. We want them to be mechanically efficient. Then we also want to see their heart rate drop when it should drop. And we want to see drop-offs that tell us that our guys are recovering well and our heart rates aren't staying elevated for an extended period of time. So those are things we look at. Most on the level 2 test, we're looking for guys. We want our bigs above 10. We use the Nike Spark version, the level 2 recovery test. We want our big guys above 10. We want our guards above 15. Those are our standards, and that kind of equates out with the formula to about a 50 VO2 max for our bigs and then about a 55 for our guards. Now, that's not, you know, lab-based test. That's not a CARP, but we use it. We're consistent with it, so therefore it's reliable for us. And that's kind of what we use as benchmarks as far as aerobic fitness is concerned.
Yeah, sounds great. And you know, that sounds like, I mean, you know, training's an art and a science, and it sounds like that, you know, it's obviously all these benchmarks aren't an exact science with these different players. There's a very strong art component to it, and it sounds like you and the work you're doing is really spearheading a lot of that. So moving into a little bit of strength training, you and I are both K-Box users. I've had the unit for a little while and really interested in some of the things that you're doing. And especially, you know, I've seen you do a lot of things like static start movements. And you've talked a little bit in other podcasts about how you will utilize the unit, especially with incoming athletes or who may not have some of the lifting technique taller athletes. What's your experience with using the K-Box, integrating it into your program? And in addition to that, is there any specific results or anecdotes that you'd like to share in your utilization of the device?
Yeah, I mean, the K-Box for me, I mean, you know, flywheel training and inertial-based devices have been around for a long time. You know, I really never, you know, looked at it intensively until Landon Evans, and I was speaking with Landon Evans and Carl Val about the K-Box, and they kind of recommended, they thought it'd be great for a basketball athlete that really lacks a lot of that eccentric strength and eccentric rate of force development. So we started looking into it. We were looking at it, and we were also looking like a pitch shark or a belt squat type device. And what I liked about the K-Box is it was great not only for our guys that came in with minimal training and exposure, but it was also great for our upper-level guys that also needed a different type of training stimulus. So for us, it suited our, you know, our developmental kids, but it also suited our high-level kids. And it gave us a tool that was very versatile, that had a small footprint, but also a big impact. And it was a very powerful training tool and a very powerful training stimulus. So when we looked at the K-Box, we brought it in. We actually got ours at the end of last summer. So we started using it in the in-season period. I'd heard rumors about DOMS and soreness from the box, but we were very methodical with how we implemented it. We started off with a little bit more of a higher frequency sessions at lower volumes and let the athletes kind of depict their pace and kind of get them, you know, introduced to the movement, so to speak. So during the in-season block, we primarily were working on, you know, bilateral squatting, but a lot of single leg work on the K-Box. What I find for our guys, our game's not symmetrical in nature. They jump off one leg, they land on the other leg, they do it a lot. Most of our guys are either left-handed dribblers or they're right-handed dribblers, so they're going to go to that side a lot more than they do the other side. So the game, and you know, the game presents a lot of natural compensations and asymmetries that are just a part of doing business. So with the K-Box, we used it a lot for single leg squat variants, a lot of single leg post chain work, and we started implementing it all throughout the season. We saw some anecdotal, decrease in complaints of patellofemoral pain, general low back pain. Our guys could get a big bang for their buck without structurally taxing themselves they would with a typical barbell squat, which we still do. But the guys look at the K-Box a little bit different than they look at 315 on a loaded barbell. So it gave us some options. And I'm a very big believer you need to have options and you need to, you know, select the right size bait to catch the right size fish. So with the K-Box, it helped us fill a lot of different gaps within our training. Then when we got to the postseason period, things have went really well. We saw better improvements on our force play scans as far as our ability to maintain our load or our ability to, you know, basically apply force into the plate. So our eccentric rate of force development was good. Our maximal strength was retained very, very well. So I know we were doing a lot of other things as well, but I have to think that I've seen better improvements and maintenance with that this year than I did in the past. So I think the K-Box definitely played into that. Now that's just a, you know, personal experience and observation. I don't have necessarily data because the guys weren't just doing K-Box. But then we got into the spring period. We talked about some of the isodynamic type stuff that we do. We actually took the guys through a kind of tissue remodeling block on that box. So we did a lot of, you know, back to the old Buddy Morris wave of induction, which is an isometric emphasis into an eccentric emphasis and then into a dynamic one. So we did a lot of, you know, tissue remodeling work with the K-Box, implementing those isometrics early on, transferring over, doing some more, you know, utilized eccentric, accentuated eccentric work on the K-Box. Then we transitioned them into some more higher, you know, low resistance, higher rate of force development work on it as well. And it went extremely well. We saw greater improvements in a lot of our standing jumps, our eccentric rate of force development, our athletes' ability to brace and transfer force improved. And our guys like it. We like it. We use it for a lot of different movements. There's not a week that goes by that the K-Box isn't implemented. Now, I don't get any money from K-Box or Go Eccentrics. I'm telling you right now, I don't get kickbacks. I don't get free stuff. I just know it works. And I know that we like it and we've seen an improvement off it. I know it's like nothing else I've ever been on. So I think it's my duty as a coach to share that information and maybe give people an opportunity to look into the technology and look into the equipment to see if it works for them. So I think the K-Box for basketball players is phenomenal because we talked about before, we see a big gap with their approach jumps and their standing verts. So that's a lack of explosive and starting strength. We see a big gap between, you know, a squat jump from a non-counter movement compared to a counter movement. We've seen guys improve tremendously on those jumps as a result of utilizing more traditional strength movements, but also the K-box. So, yeah, I'm a believer. I'm sold. So I don't know if that answers your question, but yeah.
No, it does. And one of the things that I was going to ask you, and you were talking about your athletes' discrepancies between, you know, standing jumps and running elastic jumps, and you even mentioned a little bit about the load on the force plate. Is that Sparta track that you're talking about?
Yeah, I use Sparta. You know, Sparta's been great for us. We not only use it for the force plate, but we also have made our Sparta dashboard our main hub for a lot of our data integration. It's where we aggregate a lot of our data, whether it's Catapult, a lot of our wellness tracking, injury reporting. A lot of that stuff goes through our Sparta platform. So they've done a great job with creating a hub that allows us to kind of see everything on one page, kind of look for any type of you know, signals or smoke screens that kind of pop out that we want to look at. So it gives us a great point to do that. So yeah, we do use the Sparta track system. We actually purchased that last year around the same time. We had a donor that actually saw the Sparta system on ESPN and approached me about using force plate technology. It was something that we were interested in. Had a good relationship with them, and I also know my scope of practice. I don't have time or the resources or the staff to look at force plates scans all day and look at 400 lines of data. So with the Sparta track system, for us, it makes sense because it's quick. We get guys in, we get them out. They've been great for us for a customer service standpoint as far as calling them, getting an understanding of what's going on, and they're generating more scans on a daily basis for us to compare against, and we can see some of those things. So yeah, we use a vertical jump scan. We use a single leg landing test with our guys. We use the upper body and a lower body sway analysis. So those are the four basic tests that we use in season, 7 to 10 days on the vertical jump scan. Off season, it's bi-weekly, and then we perform the sway analysis. If a guy's hurt or if it's not, we'll perform it quarterly.
Okay, yeah, awesome. I was really curious about that because actually in my neck of the woods, some of the football strength coaches a little over a year ago, the K-Box guys came in and demoed it, and they were very interested on how the K-box was going to influence the load aspect of that or the force absorption eccentric aspect of that scan. And so it turns out you're doing it and it's helping it.
Yeah. And we see changes. I think that's important for people to realize. There's a lot of tools available. You've got to select the tool that not only fits your system, but also fits your staff. There's budgetary concerns. There's time concerns. There's a lot of logistics in place. My main thing, no matter what people are using, you should measure what matters to you. You should measure what basically drives decision making, and you should measure what you understand and what you can implement and what you can, you know, practically utilize on a daily basis to make changes. Our guys like the view. They like the way it looks. They understand it. I can explain it to them. They don't understand what 4,000N means. But when I show them their load, their explode, and their drive, and I explain those different variables to them, they understand it, and they get excited about it. And then if they get excited about it, I'm excited about it because I think it helps them see something. And I truly believe if it gets seen, it gets changed. So I think it's important for us to be able to quantify not only our performance metrics, but we've also used it in return to play and return to performance situations where the ability to quantify those benchmarks during that process has been huge. As far as decreasing the chance and mitigating a lot of re-injury risk.
Yeah, a couple kind of springboarding off of that, a couple more nuts and bolts questions with the K-Box as well, because I found my use for it is a lot different than some of my athletes. And talking with Carl Val as well and using it with swimmers, I find that if I use it from a very low-rep neuromuscular training standpoint, that chemistry equation with swimming in the water destroys people's legs.
Yeah.
And what I've kind of ended up gravitating towards, and now this obviously, if I was using it with, and how I've used it with tennis players and more ground-based athletes is different. But do you find yourself using it, and how I ended up using it for swimming, I will say, is actually some lower intensity, higher rep stuff. Do you use the unit at all for any sort of hypertrophy work, higher rep type work, or is it mostly neuromuscular?
No, I get a lot of wet noodles, man. So I get, you know, I get a lot of guys that the wind picks up and we got to hold them down. So when we get them body armor, you know, improving their physical, you know, that physical maturation process that needs to take place. So there's a lot of times during the year what we can do in season when we're working on, you know, lean tissue. And that's one area I'm a big believer, not only in hydration in season, but also the ability to maintain off-season body weights, because I find that when guys become dehydrated, calories become an issue, food becomes an issue, they lose lean muscle mass, their durability, their body armor goes down, power goes down, strength goes down, internal load goes up, and then coach is looking at me and asking me, you know, why we're performing at a low level. So I think for us, we use a lot of different protocols. We use recovery protocols on it. We do a lot of hypertrophy related activity on the K-box as well, especially single leg and bilateral. So I think it fills a big gap for us. So we've used it, like I said before, you know, tissue remodeling. We've used it for hypertrophy. We use it for recovery with a small wheel. The great thing about it too is the athlete controls kind of the signal or the stimulus. So if the athlete doesn't put a ton of force into the wheel and it's repetitive and it's relaxed, and we adjust the strap length to make sure that there's no rip or no, you know, decrease, you know, the amount of, you know, rip or the pull we're going to have on the way down, we can do some flushing and some more oxidative related type activities on the K-box as well. So it's definitely multifaceted. A lot of our neuromuscular training on the box, we're using a lot of power and fatigue drop off. So we're looking at the K-meter and just looking at, okay, if we get a 5 to 7% drop off and power goes down, then that's something for us. If we're using more of a neuromuscular component, we can use fatigue and power drop offs to kind of get an idea of when we need to cessate those sets. But from a hypertrophy standpoint, we can use more RPE based. But if we're pushing hard hypertrophy, we'll do a lot of extended duration time sets. That's something we like a lot. So we did a lot of that this summer. We performed once a week. We were doing anywhere between 3 to 4 sets of anywhere between 10 to 20 reps on the K-box on our first day, one of our primary Olympic lift days. We were using that to fill in the gaps with a lot of guys. And we saw some, you know, some good improvements in lower body strength, but also how they felt, and some lean muscle mass gains as well.
That's awesome. That's awesome. I was going to say that protocol builds some tree trunks real quick.
Yeah. I want bulletproof legs. I got a lot of guys that have a lot of atrophy and a lot of discrepancy between muscle tone on both sides. A lot of the times their takeoff leg, a lot of my guys are right-handed, so that left leg is kind of the braking and takeoff leg, so it gets a lot of eccentric strain during practice, and it gets a lot of jumping, but the right leg's kind of like the redhead stepchild of the group. No offense to my redheaded intern that's currently sitting in the room with me right now. I apologize, AJ. But, you know, those are things that you have to look at. So, like, that's why we prefer a lot of single leg work on the K-box, because consistent tension, our guys have to brace. They can't leak out, and they learn how to transfer force. But also, too, our guys are all conditioned to go 0 to 100. It's all quick. On the basketball court, if you load and you're on the floor too long, you're dead. You're dead in the water. So our guys are all about quick, 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 quick. So sometimes you need to take a step back and teach them how to brace, how to maintain posture, position, and maintain tension. And we see a lot of improvements along that force curve. And we kind of surf the curve. And the words of Brad DeWeese, it's important that we kind of surf that force velocity curve on a consistent basis to make sure we're filling the gaps in.
Yeah, I like when you talk about filling the gaps. And using it for hypertrophy work especially, something I've always found over time is just doing regular up and down squats. It's almost like you're missing a lot of that feedback pattern in that half range of the squat. In the K-box, you always seem to – there's always feedback and tension the whole time you're working it.
Yeah, and you're getting a lot of bang for your buck, because most guys aren't going to be able to get that type of eccentric load with a barbell, whether it's because of, you know, technical proficiency, nature of the movement. There's always going to be that brief relaxation phase before they go in. So I think not only that, we get to do less work on it. So we get, more bang for our buck. So therefore, we can do lower volume at more frequencies and distribute that stress across the week. So yeah. Yeah, the K-box love fest is going pretty hard right now, so that's good.
Moving on a little bit, and you had talked a little bit about, you know, well, and it's pretty common knowledge, I guess, you know, basketball is jumping and cutting, and there's such a plyometric component to the game and practice itself. So when you're moving outside the game into training sessions, what is your approach to both the dosage of plyometric training in your athletes as well as the progressions?
Our jump training is always going to be reflective of our sprint emphasis. So I'm heavily influenced by Al Vermeil, Buddy Morris, James Smith, Charlie Francis, Landon Evans. So I'm, you know, when I look at that type of movement, Bouchek-Nader, when I look at that, one of the biggest areas for us from a plyometric standpoint, I think it's a very lack, there's a lack of it, and there should be more emphasis on it, is lower leg conditioning. And what I mean by that is, you know, multi-jump circuits a la Danpath, you know, multi-jump circuits where we're preparing the ankle complex, the feet, the knees, all the way up the chain, and we're preparing them for more high amplitude jumps down the road. So early on in prep, we do a lot of lower leg prep, lower leg conditioning, multi-jump circuits, pogo jumps, single and double leg pogos, a lot of in place jump rudiments. We're doing a lot of that type movement to kind of prepare the foot, improve posture, improve position, and help our athletes withstand force and build up a good base. And then we look at our jump training. I think it's important if, for instance, in our first block of our summer, we're emphasizing acceleration. We're emphasizing uphill runs, and we're emphasizing towing sleds, not only to develop special strength for sprinting, but also have our athletes interact with gravity, take down the velocity a little bit, which is a safer alternative early on in training to minimize the risk of soft tissue injury. And then our jumps are compatible with that. So we do a lot of deeper knee bend jumps that are more reflective of acceleration position. So a lot of seated box jumps, uphill jumps, single response, not continuous, a lot of deeper barbell squat jumps. We're trying to move those athletes through a full range of motion and then really maximize our displacement. So we'll use a lot of that early on in prep. And then as we kind of transition from an acceleration base, we've done our lower leg conditioning, we've done our high output jumps as far as with deep knee bend, and then we transition into more reactive elastic jumps early or later on in our summer prep, because we're also doing more higher velocity sprinting with more upright posture. So I find that the transition is much smoother and much fluid when we're emphasizing those qualities that are being mimicked both on the field with our field work and then also on the court. But that first block for us is huge, because we're trying to develop maximal strength. We're developing explosive strength and strength speed. So I want to make sure that our training modalities are compatible. Our training modalities kind of seamlessly transition from block to block. So from us, but most of my guys can jump already. It's just how they interact with gravity. Can they do that 100 times in a practice or in a game? And do they have the preparation from a structural standpoint to be able to handle that type of load? So I think you have to start small. You have to start with those lower amplitude jumps for more extended duration sets, and then progress them into jumps that really mimic and go with what your current training focus is.
Sure. So you're with the low amplitude jumps.
Yeah.
Is that a lot of like the real, or you mentioned doing obviously the high knee bend type work.
Yeah.
The low amplitude, you're talking about like the real like kind of rigid hip, knee and ankle like absorbing.
Yeah.
And okay.
Yeah. So we're looking, we start off in place. So it'd be like standing pogos, big pogos. We're looking at stiffness too. If you look at the athlete that I get, a lot of them are hypermobile due to weakness. So they lack the optimal blend of stiffness. I think everybody's like, oh, you don't want your athlete stiff. Well, it's not that you don't want them stiff. You want to find a balance with along that continuum that allows them to be. I've never seen an athlete that is explosive that's not stiff a little bit. That's just the way it goes. You know, if they're really mobile and lax, and they usually don't jump and sprint that fast. That's just me. I mean, I don't know. I deal with a different type of kid. But most of my guys that come in, and I'm like, oh, wow, look at him jump. You know, they're like plywood. So we have to find an optimal level of stiffness on both sides that allows for more of those reactive elastic and power components, but also isn't too stiff. We're putting them at a risk for injury, but it's also what makes them special. So a lot of that lower leg prep starts in place. We're not only looking at the foot and the ankle and the knee, but we're also looking at how the pelvis and how the femur interacts with those low amplitude repetitive type contacts. So we see a lot of times our guys don't have the postural stability and the postural endurance to maintain that ability. So if they can't do it on a pogo circuit, how the heck are they going to do it in a two-hour practice? So we're looking at how the hips interact. Do their pelvis, does their pelvis remain neutral? Does their upper body have a lot of, you know, lack of segmental control? Are they moving all over the place? So we're not only looking at their feet and their ankles. So we start off like on grass, barefoot, lower, really low amplitude jumps. We'll transition onto more of a track surface in place, both single and double leg amplitude jumps, and then we move, and then we start doing stuff that's point A, point B. So we'll kind of move them and take them out, and that's where we start to see some more things. So that progression starts in place, and then we use the same exercises. We're just increasing amplitude and then the difficulty and complexity of the exercise by adding locomotion into that mix. So then we'll kind of progress them throughout that. But we do a ton of those multi-jump movements, and I think it's something for me that is highly neglected. Everybody wants to be a Ferrari. Everybody wants to be a race car. But if the chassis isn't what it needs to be, the transmission isn't what it needs to be, all the horsepower in the world isn't going to do anything without any brakes and a straight frame. So I think you have to take that big picture and keep that big picture in mind.
I think that's a great point, especially with team sport athletes, and it's almost like an ends to middle approach. You're working that stiffness and rigidity and tall posture and ankle movement, as well as the low end, the deep squatting kind of corrective end of things, and moving it more into more of a holistic reactive as you go along. Am I describing that correctly?
Yeah, I think you are. And I think too is just like, it's just like anything in the weight room. Like, you're not going to come in and automatically start implementing, you know, high force, you know, high velocity movement with a barbell on day one. It takes time, and you develop competency, and you develop, you know, a base level of preparation through volume that the amplitude and the intensity is appropriate for the type of work being done. But then again, it goes back to filling those gaps. I know what they do on the court. I know what they have to be able to do. So we found over time, training athletes, you know, we've researched it, we've applied it, we refine it, and we repeat it. And we do that over and over and over again and every day, and that's kind of what we've came to.
Excellent. This next question is kind of a can of worms that could be a whole podcast.
So here we go.
Oh yeah, I'm going to try to narrow it down here just for the sake of being somewhat concise. But I know you do a lot of monitoring. So could you describe maybe at the heart of the monitoring you do, and how you feel that, or what you feel the biggest things that matter to you in your monitoring practice are? If you could pick one or two things that say, these are the most important things that stand out to me in my monitoring that really do dictate the day-to-day, and talk a little bit about that in your practice.
The most important aspect of monitoring is the head coach you work for. Number one, not what you buy, what you get, how you use it. It's the head coach and his ability to be open to the information that you're giving him, and then also be open and confident enough to use that information to change or modify, refine, improve what he's doing from a technical and tactical piece. That's the number one thing. If it doesn't start from the top, if your head coach isn't bought in, you can go spend all the money in the world, but it's just going to sit there, and you're going to look cool and post a whole bunch of tweets on social media and look like a sports scientist, but you're not getting anything done. So I think it's important that you have a relationship with your coach, you understand what he wants to look at, what he's open and willing to change, and you start small and you move on. So before you go out and buy a catapult, you want to, you know, I've talked to coaches, I want to buy a catapult. Then they don't do subjective wellness questionnaires. They've never taken body weights on a daily basis. I mean, you got to start just like training. You build a big base. You move from simple to complex, and that's what develops credibility and trust within your staff to be able to utilize that. So I think number one, that's not what people want to hear, because everybody wants to ask about all the toys that we have, but they never want to ask about our culture. They never want to ask about our organizational structure or how we take that information and provide context to our players and provide context to our coaches. So that's number one. Number two, you have to look at what your skill set is. I think there's a lot of information being brought in, but it surpasses our ability to take that information and apply context and use it. So we have all the information in the world, but it's still going to be a people-related business. We're going to have to be able to take that information, make it practical and applicable to the athletes we're working with. But we also have to make sure we have the intervention strategies in place once we get the information to actually make the changes that are going to help improve our athletes. So when I look at basic monitoring or tracking, or however you want to say it, you know, I think first and foremost, you know, the ability to track mechanical internal load is one of our primary means of sports science or technology or whatever you want to call it. So catapult tracking and heart rate monitoring are two big pieces that we do every day. That's something that we're going to do. We do our wellness questionnaires, we do RPEs, things of that nature daily. But from a technique or a technology piece, our internal load and external load is going to be two of the most important and biggest factors for us, because it basically changes what happens on the court. So for us, the plan practice, to structure our practice, taper our athletes, and prepare them for competition, it's a huge piece. So we use that daily. So we're using it live monitoring during practice. We set that up. Before practice, we do a projected load for the day. We go over that in our practice planning meetings with our staff. Post-practice, we do an actual expenditure as far as what our load was compared to what we thought it was going to be. Then we look for red flags. We compare that to our 7, 14, and kind of 22-day average, depending on what time of the year it is, kind of get an idea of where we're at. And the more data that we get, the more efficient and more productive we are with those decisions. But it definitely hasn't been plug and play. I mean, we've been doing it for 4 years, so our data set's becoming more rich, and we're able to make some better decisions off of that. But it's taken time. And then we also we use GymAware for velocity-based training. I think that a next really big piece is the ability to quantify, adaptations and intent in the weight room as far as what you're actually training and what you're trying to improve. So I think whether it's GymAware, Tendo, Push, whatever it is that you're using, I think you have to have a way to quantify the work being done to make sure the load is conducive to the results that you want to see. I deal with athletes from 5'11 to 7'2". 70% isn't 70% for all those athletes. So we've gone away from most of our upper level guys into more of a BBT auto-regulated type training environment. With our younger guys, we'll do more APRE work with those guys when they first get here. But it's a very mature and a very experience kind of training environment. There's a lot of discussion. There's a lot of referral to what the velocity looks like on the bar. I know when I put it on the bar, our guys move the bar faster. They want to see the numbers, they want to see the improvement, and it motivates them. So that's a huge plus for us. But two, I want to make sure that we're attacking the right things and have a way to generate that. Do you have to have it? No. People have been doing it for 100 years without it. But I think it helps complement what your coach's eye is already seeing, and it provides context and another quantifiable measure to help you make some more decisions. Our force plate scan, that's the third one. We use that heavily on a daily basis. And then we also use Omega Wave for HRV more heavily in season, because in the off season, I'm improving preparedness. I want to make sure our guys 100% is the best that I can make it. So if I don't improve their preparedness, I can't protect them. If I can't protect them, they can't perform. So I think it's important that we have to be able to prepare these athletes so they can perform at a high level, and that allows us to protect them better. I had a podcast with Kier the other day, and I kind of, like I told him, if you're 100% crap, it doesn't really matter if you're at 70 or 80% of it. So I think there's a big influence on recovery. There's a big influence on readiness, as there should, but there also has to be windows where you're causing stress and you're causing adaptation and you're causing some functional overreaching, where you're trying to make some long-term, gains and have some long-term training residuals that can only happen if you train your athletes hard, intelligently. But there has to be windows of where you push them to get the adaptations you want to see. So those are our biggest like technology pieces that we use on a day-to-day basis, and what we're looking at. We also use like DEXA body composition scan. The scale is also great. Tanada scale, not highly technological, but we weigh in pre-practice, post-practice. We usually weigh in every single day, just so our guys understand what their nutritional and hydration habits do to them. If they see it, it gets changed, and the guy can do something to help change it before it's too late. But those are some things that we're looking at from a monitoring standpoint. The biggest thing, coach what you know, teach what you know, buy what you can use, and then measure what matters. And understand you have to be patient, you have to be persistent, and it's going to take time. Nobody's buying anything, changing their title, and becoming a sports scientist or a high-performance coordinator overnight. It takes time. You have to give it its due diligence and understand there's going to be some frustration along the way, because every athlete's different, every team's different, and it changes from year to year.
There's so much gold in that last 5-10 minutes there, Ryan. I'm going to have to be sure to get a lot of those quotes and throw them in the show notes as well, so people can kind of see those and go over them. I was actually talking to a colleague of mine about this the other day, but it all does come back to the relationships and that you have with the your coaching staff and the athletes, and that dictating how that you can use it all. And what was really meaningful to me, being a guy who doesn't have access to a lot of these things, just what you were talking about with the load being different for a 5'11 versus 7'2 guy. We all coach athletes of different shapes and sizes, and even if we don't have just the awareness of that being a different load, I think even gives us, without those resources, the means to think about things differently.
Exactly.
So last question I'll wrap this up with is, and kind of leading in a little bit, if with all the experience you have now, being able to go through this data and being a growing thing and giving you more awareness of how athletes respond, if you were to have advice for a coach who had a 3-figure budget or less on monitoring, assessing, what is the core of what they could do or should be doing on a day-to-day with little to no equipment or money for doing those things?
The most powerful thing you can do is talk to your athletes. And talk to your coaches and ask your kids how they're doing. How do you feel? How do you move? You know, how's the warm-up looked? Are the guys talking to each other? Buddy Morris once told me one time, and he said it a lot, if your guys are talking, they're playing, you know, they're playing grab ass, excuse my language, they're playing grab ass, they're having a good time, they're ready to go. If you walk in, there's no eye contact, body language is terrible, their feet are loud, you know, they're slamming the ground, they're not moving, range of motion's been adjusted. You got to be a coach. So I think personal relationships have to come before personal records. And if you don't have that relationship, you're not going to have the dialogue and the effective communication structure to have your athletes open up and understand that, you know, it's not something where you're enabling those athletes, but you're allowing them to take ownership of their preparation and not be a victim. You're telling them, this is what you need to do. This is how you need to do it. Here's the tools that I can help you, whether or not you have a big budget or not. Here's how you hydrate. Here's how you eat. Here's how you do these things. Let me help you. And I think a lot of times in the mix, you know, we coach people. We manage people. We don't manage data. The data helps me, you know, shape my discussions with the kids and gives me something to show them, but it's not the main thing. My guys can look at a screen. My wife can look at catapult data. She doesn't know what the hell she's looking at, but she can read a line. She knows 550 player loads higher than 450. But when I provide context to what's going on and I can pull an athlete to the side, our biggest thing in our training environment, and to those coaches that are listening that don't have a huge budget, people first. Coaching will always be the most technologically and cutting-edge tool available. Visit coaches that have the things that you want to do. Learn, be prepared, so if the time comes when you need to use it, you can do it. Weigh guys in daily, weekly, whatever it is. Do body composition. Take pictures. Do wellness questionnaires. Do RPEs. You know, find a way to make it happen. Just don't say, hey, I'm not big time. I'm not a school where I can afford these things, because I started off with one heart rate monitor from Dick's and with a watch that I had to rotate between 15 kids during conditioning sessions because Landon Evans and Mark McLaughlin and Val Nasetkin said I needed to do these exact heart rates during our training session. We made it work. And it was a very pivotal moment in a formative part of our years. But overall, you can't get away from that. It sounds cliche, but what we do and why we're able to operate the way we do is because people believe in us, we're transparent, we're honest, and we're open. And that dialogue, whether it's fundraising to get the things that we have, or if it's building, generating buy-in or compliance with our athletes, we have to make sure that we have those tools in place that we can help prepare them. It's like anything else. I go into the doctor's office, I don't want to see an x-ray system from 1800. You know, I want the most advanced MRI. I want my doctor to be competent. I want the doctor to have good bedside manner, and I want him to have a treatment protocol in place that helps me get better. Your athletes are the same way, and you should treat it as such. Develop yourself as a coach, generate relationships, and then coach your ass off and get better.
Amazing stuff, and great conclusion to the show, Ryan. I think that was very well said, and I know the listeners are going to take so much away from this podcast. Thanks for being on the show today. I really appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me. I did a decent job this time of not ranting. Last podcast, it took 70 minutes to answer 4 questions, so I'm proud of myself.
So, yeah, no, your answers were amazing and concise, and I think everyone's going to get a lot out of it. So thank you again.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right, thanks for listening. We're happy to have you on today. Again, if you like the show, please rate and review it on your listening platform of choice. And next week on the Performance Podcast, we're going to have Carl Val, where him and I are going to chat a little bit about jump monitoring. And I know you guys are going to be looking forward to that one, as am I.